and welcome. I am Lizzie, your Millennial Movie Matchmaker. So let's dive right in, shall we? I want to talk about what happened this week. So I checked all of the different movies in the zeitgeist, and you know, there wasn't a lot for me. So to give a quick recap on how we do things here at the Millennial Movie Matchmaker podcast, in case that we have any new listeners, shout out to you. Typically, I pick a new movie to review, and then I pick my top five within that same genre. So what is different about this week, you might ask? Well, I just found the zeitgeist for this week a little dry. You know, we had a lot going on last week. Our 2021 has essentially said to the year 2020, hey, hold my purse. So this week was just a little dull. You know, there was a couple of Netflix movies that came out, one that is starring Shia LaBeouf, but I gotta be totally honest, I watched the trailer for it and it looked so sad. And I gotta say, just not my thing this week. I can't watch something that's so unbelievably sad that looks like it has no plot other than to make me cry. Those movies are not my style. Again, if you have been listening to this podcast, you know that character development is huge for me. So just like I cannot watch explosions with absolutely no backstory, I just can't watch miserable people without any backstory. So I went ahead and got onto the gram and I did a poll. I wanted to see, for those of you who participated, if you would rather my top five favorite 90s throwbacks or my top five favorite classic movies. And it was a hands down or Doyle rules 90s throwback all the way. And I gotta say, I'm actually really relieved, because even though I do love me some classics, the 90s decade is without a doubt my absolute favorite decade. So everybody lace up your Doc Martens, put down that Tamagotchi, snuggle up with some Dunkaroos, because we are going to talk about our favorite 90s movies. Now, here's a caveat before I get started, is that we all know what the top 90s movies of all time are, right? I mean, you could probably pretty much guess. The top five is pretty much the top five. And so I wanted to do things to switch things up a little bit. You know, I don't want you to get on here and just basically already know what I'm going to say. I want to throw you off, keep you on your toes. So I went on a couple of websites and they all more or less have the exact same thing. You know, you've got your Titanic, your Toy Story, Goodfellas, Schindler's List, Pulp Fiction. That was one list. The second list, which is by Rolling Stone magazine, pretty much the same. You've got Pulp Fiction, Silence of the Lambs, Safe, Hoop Dreams, Goodfellas. Now, these are wonderful movies. These are no shot to these movies. Honestly, Silence of the Lambs might fall into possibly my all-time favorite movie, period. So I love these movies. But again, I wanted to keep you on your toes. And there is something to be said about the 90s movies that made up the culture. You know, not necessarily the movies that are going to go down in history as some of the greatest movies of all time, but more so the movies that really defined the decade that was the 90s. So I have decided that for my top five, I'm going to do just that. I'm going to rate my top five favorite cult classics of the 90s, the movies that when you think about that decade, that is just something that automatically pops into your brain, and we're going to go for it. All right, so first, of course, in true Millennial Movie Matchmaker fashion, we are going to talk about the honorable mention. And this is pretty much, without a doubt, it has to be mentioned. And that is The Blair Witch Project. Now, is this movie my honorable mention because it's oh so good or oh so bad? Honestly, the answer is both. It is both amazing and terrible all at the exact same time. So this movie, I honestly believe, changed the course of movie making for all time. I know that sounds a little enthusiastic, but just bear with me here. So this movie will go down in history as one of the most profitable movies of all time when you just look at the ratio of how much it costs to make it versus its profit. So this film cost 60 grand to make. That's it, $60,000. This movie brought in $248 million. Somebody else did the math for me, luckily, so I don't have to. And that means that for every dollar that was spent, they made approximately $11,000. Can you believe that? And this entire movie was done completely guerrilla style. I mean, the quality is not good, but this is that first live action movie. You know, we've seen it all the time now. You've got the Paranormal Activities and all of these movies now that have really normalized this live action piece, but this was really the first to do it. So they took three actors. They took Heather Donahue, Michael Williams, and John Leonard, and basically threw them into the woods. That is the main premise of the movie, is that there's these three filmmakers. And they got to keep their names, they play themselves, and they go into the woods and they're investigating this town. I believe it's called Bedford, used to be called Blair, hence the Blair Witch. And they're trying to figure out the legend of this town. Now, they go so far, you know, at one point, you have to question, am I being pranked or is this all real? I mean, because they really went to town on trying to plug that this was the real thing. And to be honest, they were just playing a massive prank on the cast, in my opinion, because they threw them into the woods. They gave them absolutely no backstory whatsoever. And so the movie really takes place with Heather, Michael, and Josh. And they're first investigating, you know, they're in the town, they're talking to all these different people, trying to really fit you with the basic lore of this movie. And then they go into the woods. And that's when shit starts to get real. You know, if anybody has ever seen this movie, you know, you've got like the stick people. This movie just, honestly, it has to be the honorable mention because it is so choppy as a actual movie. You know, they go in and talk to all of these townspeople, and you hear this lore about how she used to lure in children to the woods, and then one by one she would off them, and then that entire lore just completely disappeared. And then they're in the woods and just like shit just goes wrong left and right. And it's entertaining to watch, but as a movie that is intended to be a horror movie, this is not scary. It's not scary. And I mean, of course, you've got the iconic, you know, Heather's got the camera up into her nose and she's, I'm so scared. I'm so scared. I mean, I guess the one thing that it did achieve is that for a while, so this came out in 1999, I would have been 11 when this came out. So I was not really able to watch it, but I had an older brother, so I was kind of able to swing those kinds of things. And I did get a little nervous every now and again because he'd play the prank on me. Like I'd go down into the basement and he'd be like standing in the corner and just freaking me out. So I guess to a degree it was a little scary. But all in all, this is not a good movie. Like this movie is the lore, they don't really establish the lore. And then once they're in the woods, the story kind of just falls apart. There's not really a flow to it. But it has to be mentioned again because this movie kind of it changed the way that we promote movies. Honestly, this was made during really like the crux of the internet. So they created a website and plugged it everywhere. I mean, they even put up missing posters of these kids. They went to Sundance and like the whole marketing ploy for this was, is it real or isn't it real? And to me, that is genius. So, regardless of how shitty this movie is, you have got to respect the fact that not only will it go down in history as being one of the most profitable movies of all time, they clearly knew what they were doing with that 60 grand. All right, so let's move on. 90s movies. Ugh, this is honestly, 90s is just one of my favorite decades. I love the culture, you know, the slang, you know, like the booyah. And I love all of the glitter makeup. You know, I really have you've seen a major comeback with that from the show Euphoria on HBO. Would I ever wear glitter makeup today? Absolutely not. But I'm also an adult woman, but I loved the style then. I remember going to elementary school and I would put the butterfly clips in my hair and I would take the gel eyeshadow and spread it over my eyes and I would wear, you know, you'd wear those shirts that looked like a bandana. It was like the shape of a bandana, and then you'd wear a matching one maybe in your hair even. Oh my gosh, and then you'd wear those super, super chunky Steve Madden shoes. Oh, those just were the days, am I right? But oh, and then the music. I love the music of the 90s. I mean, this was the birth of the boy band. My husband will tell you that I'm absolutely obsessed with boy bands. I have an obsession. If I had to choose between Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, honestly, I would go with Backstreet Boys. But I love them all. It's like choosing, it's like Sophie's Choice. I honestly can't. But the music, I just love it. I got to see Backstreet Boys in concert last September, or September 2019, I should say. And let me tell you, I have seen some concerts in my day. I have been to some emo concerts. I've been to ballets and everything in between. And let me tell you that that was the best damn concert that I have ever been to. I laughed, I cried, and everything in between. I stand hard for the boy band. But alas, this is not about the 90s culture. This is about the movies, but we are talking about the movies that shaped our culture. So let's go ahead and dive in with number 5, and that is going to be Seven. Now, this is one of the first movies that I think about when thinking about a 90s crime drama. It has a little bit of everything. So first, let's talk about the cast, and then I'll get quickly into the plot. So the cast, you have got Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kevin Spacey. This is a 90s dream team. This is the dream team. If you were to come up with your favorite actors of the 90s, these people were it. So that in and of itself, I should rest my case, but I will go on. So the movie itself revolves around Brad Pitt's character. He plays Detective Mills and his partner, played by Morgan Freeman, who plays Somerset. Now, they are two very different people. Somerset is he's a loner. He's a bachelor. He's a little older. He's lived his life. Whereas Mills is a rookie. You know, he's brand new on the force. And so they kind of clash a little bit. You know, they don't necessarily dislike each other by any means, but they don't quite see eye to eye. And again, I said that they live very different lives. You know, Somerset is a bachelor. Mills is married to Tracy, who is played by Gwyneth Paltrow. Now, I'm not really like a huge Gwyneth Paltrow fan, but she is spectacular in this movie. This movie is actually very dark, and she is, for lack of a better term, a very bright light. She's friendly, she's bubbly, she's sweet, she's everything you'd want in someone married to Brad Pitt. So anyway, the two main characters, Mills and Somerset, they start to discover these string of murders that are being done in a fashion that represents, each murder is representative of a deadly sin. Of course, anyone who knows anything about that, there are seven deadly sins, hence the name. So, you know, these victims, not only have they died in a way that is portraying the likeness of a particular deadly sin, but the victim themselves, at least you would imagine in the eyes of the murderer, has committed this deadly sin, which is why now he has taken it upon himself to punish them with the very sin that has held them captive in their life. So, for example, you've got gluttony, and that's the first one that they find. And there's this guy who just, I mean, calling him morbidly obese feels like an understatement. I mean, this guy is huge. And for, again, for lack of a better term, he just The killer has forced him to eat himself to death. So again, he forces him to die by the very sin that has afflicted him. And it goes on and on, of course, because there's seven. And you know, as the movie continues, they keep finding more and more victims. You know, they find someone who has died through lust and greed, sloth, pride. And this entire time, they are shit out of luck with being able to find the killer. So they've actually named him John Doe. And the movie essentially just revolves around them trying to catch this killer, all while evaluating the relationship that Somerset and Mills have. Because again, they start off, you know, kind of butting heads a little bit, and then as they get to know each other, those walls slowly come down. Now, originally, Denzel Washington was supposed to be cast as Mills, as Brad Pitt's character. And I actually think that as much as I love Denzel Washington, I don't see it. I think that they both bring an earnest quality. You know, they both are capable of going there in their roles. But this character of Mills, I mean, he's a rookie. He's inexperienced. He doesn't really know the ropes, so everything that he does is working off of emotion. And now you could argue, you know, perhaps Denzel Washington's performance in Training Day could be a little bit of this, you know, kind of maybe minus the actual villain portion, but that cockiness he definitely has. But there's just something about Denzel Washington where he just feels so seasoned. He just, to me, he's got this intense confidence that I would just have a hard time seeing him in the role of, as a rookie. But nonetheless, I'm really glad that they did stick with Brad Pitt. I think that he did a wonderful job. He and the director David Fincher worked together. So David Fincher was originally supposed to do The Game, which is another phenomenal 90s movie starring Michael Douglas. That is a, don't sleep on that movie. No one talks about that movie. That's a one, that's definitely one to go watch. He was supposed to make that, but he got so excited about the idea of casting Brad Pitt with Seven that he put the entire production of The Game on hold to work on this movie. The entire movie was filmed in bleach bypass, which essentially is like filming a black and white movie in color. And I think, again, that kind of alludes to that 90s drama, because it does have to be said that any crime thriller movie of its kind within this decade took itself incredibly seriously. And that's kind of what I love about it. And I love that they were able to give it that film noir vibe to it to really make it feel old-timey. Now, I don't want to spoil it because the entire point of this movie is to be able to get to the end and get to that big jaw-dropping ending. But all I'm going to say here is, what's in the box? What's in the box? And you know, if you know, you know. All right, so moving on to my number four pick, 90s movies that shaped our culture. We're gonna go with You've Got Mail. I love this movie so much. I actually just rewatched it over the holidays because it was just found on HBO Max to stream. And this movie is such a fun slice of just sweetness. It's the ultimate romantic comedy of the 90s. Now, of course, this was directed by the one, the only Nora Ephron. It has her number one leading lady, Meg Ryan, starring as Kathleen Kelly. And then you have her 90s co-star, America's sweetheart, Tom Hanks. Now, this movie was a remake of a older classic, The Little Shop Around the Corner, starring Jimmy Stewart from It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the Mary, Mary. So they were able to adapt this because that is the name of Kathleen Kelly's bookstore, The Shop Around the Corner. So the premise of this movie is that you have got Kathleen Kelly, played by Meg Ryan. She again owns a little shop around the corner. It's a boutique children's bookshop in the West Village. And Joe Fox, played by Tom Hanks, you know, this is side note, this is like one of the first and only movies where Tom Hanks kind of plays like a little bit of a prick. It's likable, but I'm so not used to that. I mean, he is America's sweetheart because he is Forrest Gump. He's Walt Disney. He's whatever his name was that got stranded on that island and fell in love with a volleyball. You know, he's known for these iconic, super, super lovable roles. And Joe Fox, he's charming, but also kind of awful all at the same time. And so he owns what could be the equivalent of a Barnes and Noble. You know, he's the man in comparison to her. So he owns Fox Books, and he is wanting to open up a Fox Books conglomerate store right next to the little shop around the corner, which is, of course, a huge risk to her business. So the two of them are complete rivals. But what they don't know is that each of them, they go back to their respective New York apartments and they log on to AOL dial-up, and they are each other's secret pen pals. That's right. They each have found somebody in an online chat group. She is Shop Girl and he is New York 152, and they met each other. They met online. They made the strict rules that they would not share any personal details, but they have formed a, not necessarily a romantic relationship, but certainly an intimate friendship. And they have absolutely no idea that they are rivals in real life. And so, of course, the movie takes you on their journey of discovering that. And it is so sweet. It's so absolutely adorable. You know, in the classic version with Jimmy Stewart, it's their actual pen pals via, you know, writing true letters, which is honestly a lost art form. You know, I wrote a letter to my friend the other day for New Year's, and it felt so good, you know, just to put pen to paper. I know that sounds so like, but it felt really nice. I think I'm going to start doing it a little bit more often. But this, of course, it's the 90s. So everything had to be a little different. They couldn't be using snail mail. They had to be using email and instant chat. Now, to me, this screams the 90s. I will never forget the years where I had the dial-up. My parents got me a computer one year for Christmas, and so I had it up in my room. I was probably about 14 or 15, and that was like the thing. You got on the AOL instant chat. You know, you had to do the or I can't, sorry about that terrible impression, but you would go online, you'd wait for the dial-up, and then you've got mail. And I cannot tell you how many evenings I spent on AOL instant chat with all of my friends. My instant name was Liz Abo 09. So LizAbo 09. But my mom made me change it because she was so worried that people would read that and think Lesbo. And it's so not funny because it's 2021, but there's something about that at that time that I found absolutely hilarious. So I am no longer Lizaboo09. I can't even remember what I changed it to, but that, you know, RIP. So anyway, this movie it's amazing. It absolutely screams 90s. First, let's talk about Meg Ryan's clothes. I mean, her jeans go up so high. Honestly, thank God that the high-rise jeans are back. The low-rise jeans, may they never come back. May they stay dead forever. I know fashion is cyclical, but may they absolutely never, ever make a comeback. I love how high her jeans are. I want my jeans to be that high every day. And but I will say, though, to her fashion, her eyebrows are so thin and so far apart. The amount of waxing that she had to do in order to prepare for this movie, I shudder to think about it. It's so funny, all those trends. I mean, now it's like you want them to be as bushy as humanly possible. But at one point in the 90s, it was like, dear God, they have to basically be non-existent. I digress. So one reason why I absolutely love this movie is So it's loosely based on Pride and Prejudice, right? So it's got some big time Pride and Prejudice vibes. They even go a little meta and talk about Pride and Prejudice, you know, being two people who are like-minded, who love books. And certainly Joe Fox has some Mr. Darcy vibes, right? You know, he's handsome and he's charming, but he's also really cocky and stuffy and takes himself way too seriously. And you know, and but then Elizabeth Bennet is, you know, she's not necessarily innocent either. You know, she has a lot of pride and she's got these convictions that she just and these principles that she absolutely will not bend on, which, you know, on one hand is completely admirable, but then on the other, she's kind of her own worst enemy. And so the two of them, in a lot of ways, have there's a lot of parallels. And I love when they're able to take those classic stories, but then apply them to modern day life at that time. You know, you've got all of the drama and the fun and the story character development that Pride and Prejudice had, but then you're mixing it with AOL chat. And it just, that juxtaposition really does it for me. Also, side note, if you haven't seen this movie, go see it. Absolutely go see it. And if you haven't seen it in a while, I urge you to give it a rewatch, if for no other reason than the fact that Dave Chappelle is in this movie. Can you believe that? Dave Chappelle. I mean, he was in like the heydays of the Chappelle Show at this time, so I'm not surprised that he was in it, but his cameo, it slaps. All right, so moving on, we have got my number three pick, and we're gonna go with Kiss the Girls. Now, this movie is a total sleeper. Like, people sleep on this movie, and I don't get it. So some of my really good friends, they came up with the idea of a movie bracket, just like how you do with March Madness with basketball. So we all came up with our top 10, I believe it was 10 favorite movies. And then we would all get together and rank them one by one until we finally got to amongst the eight of us, we finally got to our top favorite movie, which one was the actual best. And so I decided to play this with my family and we did it all. I mean, it takes a prep. I mean, I urge you to play this game with some friends. It's fun, but it's an investment of time, certainly. But we played with my family and this was one of my picks and it won. It won. It is that good that it beat out a lot of other really fantastic movies within my parents. You know, it beat out some classics like The Searchers with my parents. It beat out The Greatest Showman. It beat out, you know, it even beat out to them. It even beat out Silence of the Lambs. Can you believe that? But I really love this movie. I'm not necessarily saying that I like it more than Silence of the Lambs. Let's be clear. But it is a damn good movie. So this actually is probably my favorite genre of all genres. It's actually kind of one that I have coined myself. It is just a cheesy Ashley Judd thriller. She makes these, she's kind of known for these, right? You know, she's got this Kiss the Girl, she's got the Double Jeopardy, she's got the Twisted. You know, she loves these kinds of movies where she plays this very strong female role who's on the run. And I'm here for it. So the movie revolves all around Ashley Judd's character for a portion of the time. She plays Dr. Kate McTiernan, and she is a, you know, she's a wonderful, well-rounded woman. Again, she is a doctor. She works well with children. She boxes. She's beautiful. She's the total package, right? Well, so the movie involves her and Detective Alex Cross, and he is played by none other than Morgan Freeman. Again, we get another one. Now, Alex Cross is a true Renaissance man. He is a detective, but he is also a doctor himself. And so he is investigating a string of kidnappings slash homicides that all revolve around young women. And although these women are very different, their common denominator is that they are all exceptional, whether that be that they are very talented or very smart, very beautiful, whatever it be, they are a hyperbolized version of what a quote woman should be at that time. Now, he is investigating this just as his job, but it very quickly becomes personal when his niece Naomi is taken. Now, she, what makes her exceptional is she is a phenomenal violinist. And so she is kidnapped. So all of a sudden, this is elevated for him, right? It's no longer just about a job. He has got to find these women. He's got to find his niece. Now, to bring it back to Ashley Judd, she herself, Kate McTiernan, is also exceptional. She is a very successful doctor. And so she is taken. So you watch all of these young ladies be kidnapped and go through, you know, these really traumatic experiences, especially for the 90s at that time. I mean, this was kind of a pretty groundbreaking movie in terms of what they actually showed. And so Kate is also kidnapped. And so you're watching both things happen in tandem. All of these women are captured, and then you have seen Kate herself be captured. Now, Kate, being as smart as she is able to actually escape from her captor's grasp. And so now she is extraordinarily valuable to Alex Cross because she is the only person that has actually heard this person's voice, experienced and heard all of the sounds, the sights, the smells of where they're being held captive. So the two of them team up together to bring the bad guy down. Now, this movie, it is a fun ride. Again, it can be somewhat triggering. It can be somewhat graphic, but it is such a wild ride. And this particular captor, this killer, he calls himself Casanova, or the Lover. And he's convinced himself that these women are madly in love with him, that the feeling is mutual. And so the whole time, you're cringing every single time you hear his voice. But what makes this movie so exciting is that you don't actually ever get to see his face. So you have no idea who the killer is the entire time. And this movie is filled with red herrings. I mean, every single time you think that you have got it figured out, there's another turn. I mean, Alex Cross, he's got a partner. Then he goes into the police station. He runs into all the police officers and the sheriff in that town. It is so good. There's, you know, at one point they investigate a teacher of Naomi's. This movie is literally filled to the brim of red herrings. You will never figure it out. And then when you finally do, it's so good. I absolutely love this movie. I think that this movie embodies, again, that same piece that I was talking about earlier with Seven about how it takes itself so seriously. I love that about these movies because you could easily go down a campy route and make this movie cheesy, and I'm sure that it would still be good, but there's just something to be said about a movie that takes itself seriously. It's so much fun to watch. You're hanging on the edge of your seat, and it's just, the writing is smart. I miss the days of smart writing. It feels like nowadays they just want to put in more explosions, more titties, and more of anything that's just going to get your attention. Like, we're little toddlers that just need shiny objects. We need the story. The story has got to be there. We gotta care. And I love this movie because it's a thriller, but they really do focus on shaping those characters so that when the killer is finally revealed, your jaw's on the floor and you've personally invested in watching these characters. And so you've got to figure out what they're, you're on the edge of your seat the entire time. And, you know, you could really argue that these movies, particularly with Ashley Judd, she kind of paved the way for the strong female protagonist, right? You know, because in the early 2000s, there were so many movies with the female protagonist. You know, there was Match Point, The Changeling, even Panic Room. And these movies, all what they have in common, they all have a strong female protagonist. Yes, they're beautiful, but it's not necessarily about that. It's about the fact that they're tough. They're not willing to go down without a fight. And I truly do believe that Ashley Judd and this movie and the others that she made like it during this decade paved that way for women everywhere. All right. I am so excited about this one. Okay. So this is my number two top favorite 90s movies that shaped the decade. And that is going to be, ladies and gentlemen, Scream. I love this movie. When I talked to my husband, I told him on Monday night after I had gotten the Instagram votes in on what we were going to do. And as we're eating dinner with our family, he literally looks over at me and he's like, so am I safe to assume that Scream is going to be on this list? I'm like, you're damn right it is. That is exactly, I mean, I love this movie so much. It's probably one of my all-time favorite movies. Actually, in fact, I know it is because going back to the bracket that I was telling you about, Scream was on there. Did it make it very far in everybody else's eyes? No, but it did in mine, and that's what matters. So this movie, I have so much to say about this movie. First, let's just talk about the plot. So I can't really talk about this movie without talking about the opener. Spoiler alert, because I have to do it. So the movie opens up with none other than Drew Barrymore and her character. She's popping popcorn. I think a lot of people actually were drawn to this movie because Drew Barrymore was going to be in it. And so she gets a phone call. Again, she's by herself. She's popping some popcorn and there's a voice on it, and I might try, but only just once because it's so hard. But it's like, hello. It's like this very almost like borderline sexy voice on the other line. And they get into this conversation. At first, there's some mild flirtation. And then you very quickly discover that this person is either playing a very sick prank or she's actually in trouble and there is some kind of psycho stalker coming after her. And now he plays a game with her where he gives her some trivia. Now, I have to say that I am pretty confident that, God forbid, if I ever be in this situation, I would like to think that I'd be able to get out of it through movie trivia. But, you know, I don't know. They say that right when you get too cocky is right when you go down. So, knock on wood, I never have to experience that. Anyway, I digress. So she asks the question. She starts to, you know, at first she's doing good. She's answering the questions. And then he throws in a trick question about Jason Voorhees' mother. Ooh, ouch. And then that's pretty much it. She is a goner right from the, I mean, she is out of that movie within the first 5 minutes. And her performance in that is absolutely stellar. She's hysterical the entire time. It's amazing. I did a little bit of research, and apparently, in order for her to be able to get emotional, Wes Craven had showed her, the director, he showed her a article about some asshole who like did some horrible things to some puppies. And every single time he wanted Drew Barrymore to cry, he would bring that article back up in order for her to cry. And she would be so upset thinking about it that she'd just start bawling right on cue. So a little bit of a weird director trick, but at least it worked. And she did an absolutely amazing job. But very quickly, you obviously learn that she is not the star of this movie. The star of this movie is Sydney Prescott. She is played by Neve Campbell. She's your all-American girl with a past, right? So she is known as the sweet, innocent girl in town whose mother was brutally murdered only 1 year prior. So she goes to high school. She goes to her school following the murder of Casey, Drew Barrymore's character, and the entire school is completely in mayhem. Everybody's being interviewed by the police, and including her boyfriend, Billy, who is played by Skeet Ulrich. She's got her best friend, who is played Tatum, who is played by Rose McGowan. And then her boyfriend, Stu, who is played by Matthew Lillard. So the four of them are the popular kids in school. And then there's kind of, you know, the quintessential tag-along, Randy, who is played by James Kennedy. Now, they are the focal point of this movie, along with a sweaty tryhard of a news anchor, Gail Weathers, who is played by Courtney Cox, and the town deputy played by David Arquette, Deputy Dewey. And so these are your main ensemble casts. And so the whole movie is really kicked off by Drew Barrymore or Casey's death. And he's not stopping there. You know, they've coined the name Ghostface because he's wearing that traditional, like, obviously you're not going to be able to see my face, but kind of picture like a woman putting on mascara. You know how like their mouths just immediately just drop agape open? That's kind of what I imagine, just with blacked out eyes and a blacked out mouth and just kind of a drapey black cape on. And so this killer is going around. He's knocking off people left and right. And what makes this movie so brilliant, what makes it so groundbreaking, is that this movie is able to break the fourth wall of its own genre while still being a movie within said genre. Yes, you have Randy, the nerdy kid, the sweaty tryhard of the friend group. He is a movie connoisseur. So he very quickly realizes that they're in the middle of a horror movie. And so he is able to guide his friends through this process while giving you the traditional rules of a horror movie. Now remember, this movie was made in 1999, but to look back on some of the really famous movies before, you know, you've got Psycho, you've got Wes Craven's Nightmare on Elm Street, you've got John Carpenter's Halloween. I mean, these are some of the most traditional horror thriller slasher movies of its time. And so they're able to really dissect the rules of these movies, because of course these movies were originally written to try to promote purity and chastity. And so of course you're only going to survive if you don't drink, you don't do drugs, and you don't have sex. So this movie, honestly, it's absolutely brilliant. I can appreciate if it's not for you, if maybe this slasher movie isn't for you, but you have to at least respect what it had done for the genre. It created the new, like, meta genre, if you will, which is the movie that's aware of itself, that isn't afraid to poke fun at itself while still also being scary, being frightening. It's still a slasher movie. You know, have all those parodies of Scary Movie 1, 2, 3. I mean, there's so many. But, you know, of course, and those are meant to poke fun at it, but they're not scary. They're not horror movies. This movie was truly, truly groundbreaking. And that is the fun thing about this entire franchise. You know, even the sequel pokes fun at itself. You know, it talks about how sequels are never as good as the original film. And then the third is all about the trilogy. The fourth was made about 10 years later. And so that's all about the reboot. I mean, they are really masterful in the way that they're able to be so self-aware, yet be such a commanding movie within their genre. So this entire movie, it has all of the 90s pieces that you want to it. It's got the music, like the down with a red right hand. It's so good. And the clothes, of course, you know, you don't have the high-rise jeans like Meg Ryan. You have the jeans that, frankly, I wish would die. But on somebody like Rose McGowan, they look pretty phenomenal. You know, she's got the lollipop in her hand at all times. And then you've got the homoerotic friendship between Stu and Billy together, where, you know, they've got this toxic masculinity with each other. But then you kind of wonder maybe what happens behind closed doors. And I just, I love this movie so much. This, honestly, this movie changed horror movies. I know I already said that, but it's true. I mean, it completely flipped so much around about the genre. You know, you were kind of going through a little bit of a slow phase for the horror genre. You know, you had your traditional slashers like your Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees. And then things kind of took like a weird left turn in the 80s. You know, you had like Child's Play, where like the little Chucky doll and Candyman, and kind of these like really extra gory movies that are going more for the effect and less really for the story or at least the mystery, because half of the fun about these movies is not knowing who's done it, not understanding the motive. You know, you want to be able to follow along on that journey while still being terrified. And this movie really brought that back in a big, bad way. You know, after this movie, you immediately had a true reboot of horror movies. You know, you had I Know What You Did Last Summer. Then you had a million different sequels of Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. And, you know, and then honestly, the doors kind of opened up to all these other options. You know, you had the entire Saw franchise, which pretty much took over the early aughts and 2010s. But with all of those movies that are missing, that Scream has, is the ability to be self-aware. And so for that, I think that this is a horror movie that not only shaped the 90s, I think it shaped the genre as a whole. I'm going to say it. Come for me if you will. I'm ready. All right. So without further ado, we are ready to talk about my number one favorite 90s movie of all time that shaped the decade. And I'm curious as to what's maybe going on in your mind, what you're thinking of, but I would imagine that most of you have hit this on the money, and we're going with Clueless. Now, whenever I ever think of the 90s decade, even if I'm not even thinking about movies, I think about Clueless. That is how 90s this movie is. The clothes, the music, the language, everything about this movie completely shaped this entire decade. So the movie itself revolves around the main protagonist, and that is Cher. She is played by Alicia Silverstone. This was, I would say, her breakout movie, and I know that she's done plenty of work since then, but this to me was like, this was her peak. And her character Cher is this vapid, shallow shopper from Beverly Hills who is just trying to make her way in high school and find love and popularity, and we get to have a front row seat along for the ride. Now, one of the reasons why this movie is so amazing is her quotes. And again, this movie is funny. It's meant to be a comedy, but what I absolutely love about Alicia Silverstone's character is she's so earnest. She delivers all of her lines so seriously, which only contributes to the character's vapidness. You know, she's so unbelievably unaware that is what makes it so great to watch. You know, she's searching for a boy in high school is as useless as searching for meaning in a Pauly Shore movie. And so the whole movie is revolved around her, and you've got her best friend, Dion. And the way that she describes her, she immediately introduces her. You know, she's my friend because we both know what it's like to have people be jealous of us. And so that very quickly introduces you to her morals and her values in life. And this movie is so amazing. Now, I loved this movie. This movie came out in 1995. So I was only 7 years old when this movie first came out. So I can't imagine I watched the movie for the first time then. But my first memories of watching this movie, I was probably about 12 or 13. And so much of this flew right over my head, right? Like, I was just focused on the cool sayings, you know, like the as if, and you know, you make the W with your fingers and whatever, and just all of the amazing plaid clothes and ways that they were able to make Dr. Seuss hats fashionable. Like, I was absolutely hypnotized by it. And I remember making my dad so angry one day because I said, you know, oh, I just want to live their life. And I didn't mean search for boys to have sex with and popularity, because again, I'm 12. I have no idea what those things are. I just really, really wanted a yellow plaid jacket with a matching skirt and tights. But this idea, I had a conversation about it with my friend, about movies that you watch when you're a kid and all of the humor, the entire plot just kind of flies right over your head, and then you rewatch it later as an adult and think, huh, Okay, I know, now I get it. And we were having that conversation, and Clueless was definitely one of these movies for me. Another one, American Pie. That was the very first R-rated movie that I've ever seen. And I remember being just like, not really, I had no idea what he was doing to that pie. Absolutely no idea. So I remember just being like, I don't really understand what's going on, but like, I don't really get why that dad's mad. I had no clue. Another one was Fear with Reese Witherspoon and Mark Wahlberg. That movie is so good. And you know, they're on the roller coaster together, and he is going to, I guess maybe you'd call that like third base with her, perhaps, maybe second. I'm not really sure with how the kids rank it these days, but either way, I had no idea what was going on. I was just like, why'd she have that face? You know, I had no idea what was going on. So this was Clueless, rewatching this absolutely got that for me. You know, I had no idea that there was such a huge pull for boys within this movie, but one definitely reigning theme over this movie is virginity, right? So Cher is a virgin, all of her friends are not. And so she is kind of feeling like she's at a place in her life where she's ready to take that step, but she hasn't really found anybody that reciprocates those feelings for her. So, you know, she's, when you see the movie, you know, she's feeling pretty melancholy. And it just so happens that a new girl in school comes in and she becomes Cher's new project. Now, this character, Ty, is played by the late, great Brittany Murphy. She's a little bit of a stoner girl. You know, she's got kind of like that New York accent, like, no shit, you guys got Kokia? Like, she's so cute and adorable. And so Cher and Dion take Ty under her wing. They give her a beautiful makeover, and Cher kind of just like lives vicariously through her. And that more or less is what the movie is about. Now, you've got her family life. So she has her ex-stepbrother, Josh, who is played by Paul Rudd, and he looks the exact same. I mean, talk about, I mean, there's all those conspiracy theories about Pharrell being a vampire, but nobody really talks about Paul Rudd too much. They do now, but there was a long time where no one really acknowledged that the man doesn't age. And so he plays her ex-stepbrother who always still hangs around the house because he has a wonderful relationship with her dad, who is played by Dan Hedaya. And he is one of the best parts about this movie. You know, they introduce him very quickly. Like, their maid in the house is absolutely terrified of him. And then you have Cher narrating, Daddy's a litigator. That means he's the scariest kind of lawyer. And he actually encourages Cher to negotiate her grades. You know, there's a scene, which reminds me, where's your report card? Cher, it's not ready yet. What do you mean it's not ready yet? Cher, well, some teachers are trying to lowball me, Daddy. And I know how you say never accept a first offer. So I figure these grades are just a jumping off point to start negotiations. And his response is very good. The dad has some of the best lines in this entire movie. You know, at one point, she finds this guy that you think at one point is going to be it for her. You know, I think she even thinks it too at one point. And as they're leaving the house, the dad, Mel, looks over at him and says, anything happens to my daughter, I have a 45 and a shovel. I doubt anybody would miss you. And that is just one of the best things about this movie. It is so quotable. And I mean, some of these things you might get looked at strangely if you say in public, you know, oh my God, I'm totally bugging. Or, you know, their way of referring to a woman's menstrual cycle, you know, I, Mr. Hall, I'm riding the crimson wave. And I absolutely love how they took all of the themes of the 90s and basically hyperbolized them and put them into this movie with the flashy colors and the music. And oh my gosh, that ending song, where is the tenderness? Where is the tenderness? Where is it? Oh, I love that song so much. So this movie is loosely based on Shakespeare's play Emma. You know, same kind of concept. This high society woman is trying to play matchmaker. And again, what they do, what I love how, you know, You've Got Mail, they took a classic and then they applied it to the 90s. They do the exact same thing. And This movie just, it holds up. The humor is so sophisticated. It is so much fun to watch. This is the type of movie you're not going to get bored while you're watching. You're going to laugh. There's going to be a couple heartfelt moments, but most importantly, it's just going to be fun. And you know what? I'm going to leave you with this. Cher, as shallow and clueless as she might be, she actually did get one thing right. So there is a scene where she's in the middle of her debate class and they're discussing the issue of refugees. And so she is the former. And so she's about to give her debate on why she approves it. And she decides, instead of actually talking about the issue, to talk about her father's garden party. She's like, so I was doing this for my father's like 40th birthday, right? And there were people that came that like did not RSVP. But it turned out that we just went to the kitchen, rearranged some things. And at the end of the day, it was like, the more, the merrier. So if America could just go into the kitchen, rearrange some things, then we can certainly party with the Haitians. And her one famous quote that I think that we can all take with us today in 2021 is that it does not say RSVP on the Statue of Liberty. Mic drop. All right, guys, we did it. We did it again. Now, hopefully next week I will be back with a new movie to review. But if not, we'll keep doing this. You know, let me know if you like it. And hey, feel free to comment down. Let me know what your favorite movie of the 90s is. What is the number one movie that you think about when you think of the 90s? Now, it would mean a lot to me if you would rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I'll see you next week.